Grapple fans, and welcome to the latest installment of March Mania, the podcast series for the month of, wait for it, March, in which myself, you let me tell you something, co-host Lorcan Mullen, and the bombastic Bob to my bodacious Bart.
Mr. Simon Grass, I knew you'd use that one. I'm like, will I get to, like, at 1% of my brain is, will I be hawk or animal? And I remember that Lorcan would never do that.
Talk about a match from the history of WrestleManias, sometimes with a guest. Unfortunately, this time our scheduled guest was unable to make it on time. We will hopefully get them on the show in the future. But this is a good one for a one-on-one conversation, because this is a WrestleMania that's very pivotal for my experiences. And also, I think you can argue this is the other WrestleMania one in the history of WrestleManias, where there's a clear, now this is part of the pop culture landscape. Because I remember the day at the Monday going into school, Mike Tyson knocking out Shawn Michaels was on the front page, or on a front page. It might have been in the sports section of one of the newspapers. Because every break time at school, me and my friends used to go into the school library, because that's the kind of people we were. And we grabbed the newspapers, and we basically try and do like a Radio 4, Have I Got News For You riff on the news that we were looking at as we spent our times not playing football or engaging in any kind of physical activity.
This is the most Lorcan Mullen story you've ever told on this podcast.
And that's saying something. I wasn't even Lorcan then. Anyway. Do you want my favourite, like, this is a harsh one. Actually, it might not have been at that event, but someone was reading the newspaper. This was a few years later. It must have been 2001, I guess. Whenever Pop Idol happened, you know, Gareth Gates against Will Young.
Okay, yeah.
And someone was reading the paper and he said, oh, Gareth Gates has just had an endorsement from the National Stutterers Society. He famously had a stutter.
Yeah.
And quick as a flash, I just said, I bet their meetings go on for a long time.
Oh.
Hey, it was 2001.
And Donald Trump's still doing it in 2024, so yeah. you're in company.
I was going to say. And talking about, hey, it was 2001, there's not many more, hey, it was 1998 matches more than the one we're going to cover for this episode. But I will contend during this conversation that this might be one of the most significant matches in pro wrestling for where it went after this. So, Simon, what are we talking about? And where are we? And when is it?
So, we are talking about a match that took place on the 29th of March, 1998, at WrestleMania 14, held at the Fleet Center in Boston, Massachusetts. It's a mixed tag team match, the third ever one in WrestleMania history. And it takes place between the artist formerly known as Goldust and Luna Vachon, and Mark Merrow and Sable.
So, I guess this will be my point of contention for this, Simon, is without this match, we might never have had the WrestleMania 35 main event of Ronda Rousey versus Becky Lynch versus Charlotte Flair.
We're famously now in 2K24, name redacted, announcing Charlotte Flair.
And the reason I say this is that this is the match, I think, that essentially made them realize we can bring back the women's title and we can build it around someone that finally fits an aesthetic that the WWF can get behind.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've had times in the past where the WWF had a women's division. And I think Vince always wanted there to be some sort of women's division if he could make it work to what he thought a women's division needed to have. If you look at WrestleMania 1, if we were to do this how we originally envisioned it, of 40 matches, 40 manias, and the idea was that we wouldn't repeat any wrestlers and we'd cover 40 matches, a match per WrestleMania, I think one of the good ones that you could have done, so that there's not as much of a knock-on effect of having to then eliminate loads of other matches at past or future WrestleManias, would have been the Wendy Richter against Leilani Kai match at WrestleMania 1. Arguably, the way that it was being billed, and because of the involvement of Cyndi Lauper, the second most important match on that card. But obviously, as everyone knows, or not everyone knows, but are you aware of the Wendy Richter situation after this?
Did she ask for more money?
Those are all the sorts of stories that you hear. It's not necessarily, you know, what is enough to get a woman sacked in the eyes of the WWF is obviously a very different kettle of fish. But she famously had a match with Spider Lady, and it essentially turned into a shoot pin that saw her lose the match, and then Spider Lady was unmasked to reveal the Fabulous Moolah, because apparently the Fabulous Moolah is a model employee compared to Wendy Richter. So then the women's division was just... It still remained in the WWF throughout the 80s. There was an all-women's Survivor Series match at the 1987 Survivor Series. You had Sensational Sherry there that they could have built it around, but it's not really much fun to build it around a heel. And Moolah was genuinely now, at last, probably too old for Vince to accept that she would be an acceptable face of any kind of part of his promotion. She was a valet for Harley Race in the late 80s as well. And she was a part of the Hulk Hogan rock and wrestling cartoon. I think Wendy Richter was on that as well. But by 1989, 1990, there was no women's championship. And Sensational Sherry, who basically was the division at that point, became a really good valet, manager, just general on-screen personality. And she was involved in the first mixed tag match that they reference in this episode, in this in commentary, against Dusty Rhodes and Sweet Sapphire, with the Macho King Randy Savage by her side. And obviously we've covered some of this in the Hogan in the Savage Warrior match. So coming into this one, so then after that we've got the Alundra Blaze run, where again there was a woman that Vince thought had a marketable enough look that he could put her prominently. And as a magazine reader, she was always very prominently placed within the magazine. But I think it was just again an issue of the roster is just Alundra Blaze against whoever's challenging her for the women's title. So first it was Luna, then it was Bull Nakano, then it was Bertha Faye, and then it was going to be Aja Kong, but that fell through. So it was always a roster of like two or three women. It's along the lines of that South
and half of those are imports from like Joshi wrestling as well.
Yeah, that was for, yeah, obviously. And two of the best Joshi wrestlers of that time, and one that's now being announced to be in the Hall of Fame. And we've covered all this at least part a truncated version when we were talking about the SummerSlam 94 match they had and in our Match of the Week episode, so search that one out in your archives. But with this one, the key is that the WWF has always, as I said, they wanted to have a prominent woman on display. When Alundra Blaze flamed out, their next point of attention was Sunny, because she joined in with the Body Donnas. She'd had a run with Chris Candido in Smoky Mountain Wrestling and other places. And she had a very marketable look. She was gorgeous back in those days. She had a real Marilyn Monroe blonde bombshell vibe to her. And she was charismatic as well. She had a vibrancy and a personality that just leapt from the screen. And so they put her a lot more prominently positioned than they ever did Skip from the Body Donnas. They made the tag team division about her, not about the tag teams that were competing for the belts.
Well, Sunny effectively became a belt.
Yeah. And then after that, she was still kept on screen, but it was that case of they didn't know what to do with her, because unlike Alundra Blaze, whilst Alundra Blaze didn't have the personality, Sunny doesn't have the athleticism. So they couldn't put her in a match because she couldn't do anything like that. I mean, so throughout 1997, once she stopped really being a manager, she was like a ring announcer, a commentator, she co-hosted Livewire, she'd do skits with Todd Pettengill and everything, but she really couldn't do... I remember in the 1998 Royal Rumble, she came out as a guest referee for the minis. They had a minis match, you know, the Mexican smaller wrestlers, and she had to do a spot where she leapfrogged to one of those mini wrestlers and she kneed them in the face. So obviously there was never going to be an athletic aptitude for her to think we can train her up to wrestle and then make her our champion and build a women's division around her.
That's okay, though. She can rely on like her many like mental talents and smart and well-rounded decision-making abilities that I'm sure have got her through to today.
Well, she's one of the great tragedies. Not just like, obviously, like I said, 1995-96, Sunny is genuinely stunning. And that's not the most important thing of what has changed in her life. But it's a great way of really visualizing how terrible her life has gone. And obviously... Mm. I have some lack of sympathy for what she did, but also she's a very tragic case. And
yeah,
there's nothing else that can be said about that. But also, by 1997, by mid-1997, it was obvious that there was a new kid on the block. A new cat in the cat house.
Mm.
And Vince, and both Vince McMahon and Vince Russo and... Kevin Dunn, as Jim Cornette has relayed in his experiences backstage, very much had their eyes taken in another direction.
Yeah.
And again, it's funny, it coincides with the WrestleMania, the last WrestleMania we cover, WrestleMania 12. In that show, Triple H gets squashed by the Ultimate Warrior. And in the months leading up to that show, Triple H would come out with a different valet every time. It would always be attractive women. It was always that question of, does Triple H have his head in the game, or is he more interested in the women he's with? No pun intended, but there we go. And for WrestleMania 12, they make a point, that's maybe the most beautiful woman he's had so far. I can't believe it. And that woman then turns out to be none other than Sable.
Yep.
The reason she was brought in was because Vince had hired Mark Mero, and when he met Sable for the first time, apparently, according to Jim Cornette, he was just smitten. Because Sable had certain qualities that Vince McMahon definitely enjoyed. And given the reaction that the male crowd has when Sable is involved in this match in the slightest, you can see that he's not the only person. 1998, you got to remember, this is the time of Pamela Anderson. This is the time of Jenny McCarthy. This is the time of Victoria Silvstedt, Playmate of the Year. This is the time of FHM and all of those sort of magazines and everything like that. Is the blonde bombshell ideal is what we have. And given the level of attention that Sydney Sweeney's getting now, it's obvious that things don't really change.
The more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yes. And so they very quickly want Sable to be like the face of the company insofar as like doing, again, events with, like there's an event at SummerSlam 97. It's her and Sunny with Todd Pettengill doing like a car competition or something, that like everyone gets these keys and they can open a door. Mm. And it's interesting when you watch that, like Sunny is so much more charismatic, like flirts with the camera, does all that sort of stuff. Whereas Sable, like Sable's got obviously a presence and we see it in this match, but there is like, again, it's like she has more in a certain area and that's what makes Vince like her more. And then you had in 1997, she takes part in the Slammies bikini competition, wears a very revealing outfit for that, and that then we're off to the races. And also what was significant around that time is that Mark Mero, who Vince had really wanted to build up, because apparently he loved the Johnny B. Badd character in WCW.
Okay.
He loved that gimmick. When Mark Mero signed for WWF and Mick Foley as Mankind signed for WWF around the same time and debuted within a day of each other, because Mark Mero gets into a fight with Triple H backstage at WrestleMania 12 after Triple H tries to take his fury out on Sable.
Oh, okay.
And so then Sable gets partnered with Mark Mero as his valet and they do a whole leather gimmick because they couldn't do the Johnny B. Badd gimmick. So instead he's the Wild Man. And like the Sable theme tune was originally Mark Mero's theme tune. He was meant to be sort of, I guess it was meant to be a bit like the Wildcat thing that Triple H, that Vince tried to give along those lines to
Kofi Kingston.
Keith Lee. Do you remember that when he was
Bearcat?
Yeah. I think he was similar, that line of thinking, because it was based on a wrestler that Vince liked in the 50s or the 60s or whatever it was.
Yeah, and there was also a promo where Kofi Kingston like christened himself the Wildcat Kofi Kingston.
So Vince likes cats? I don't know. Let's not get into that way, because God knows how he spells cat when we know he spells other variations.
Oh, Christ.
But anyway.
Yeah.
And so Mark Mero and Sable are a very heavily pushed act in 1996 to the start of 97. And they are over with the crowd, but it is more Mark Mero focused. Like, there's clearly a side of Vince that thinks this guy could be a future WWF champion, even though in relative terms he's quite short as far as a wrestler goes. But he had a great physique, and he had a great way of wrestling, that high-flying wrestling. His finisher was a shooting star press. He does a double jump moonsault where he's on the top rope and turns around. Like, I think Shelton Benjamin did a similar kind of move to that as well. He was having some really interesting matches with Steve Austin. He has the semi-final match with Steve Austin at the 96 King of the Ring that then led to the Austin 316 catchphrase. And Mark Mero, like I said, in the mid-card in 96, Mark Mero was having some very promising matches and feuds with Steve Austin, with Triple H and Goldust and so on and so forth. Has a brief run with the Intercontinental title, but then he loses that to Triple H, and sometime in early 97 he gets injured and he's out of commission. And that injury really clearly affects the way that he can wrestle as well, because when he comes back, they've completely repackaged him. And I guess they think in 97, building up Attitude Era, the Wildcat kind of gimmick doesn't really work anymore.
Yeah.
And instead, they go back to Mark Mero's history of boxing before he got into wrestling. He was a great boxer.
Yeah, Golden Gloves.
Yeah.
And as well, JR mentions he was on Team USA for boxing at one point as well. Yeah.
So at that point, he then comes out with the boxer gimmick, but they also have turned him heel in the process, or they're in the midst of turning him heel. And it's basically a repeat of the Randy Savage, Miss Elizabeth dynamic.
Yeah.
But instead, Miss Elizabeth is more provocatively attired.
Yes.
The reason people loved Elizabeth, as I said, she's like a cross between a Hollywood starlet and a reception teacher. She's got that kind of, like, the sauciest she ever got was when she revealed she was wearing bikini bottoms at SummerSlam 88. That was her big moment, but Sable's big moments would be taking off a sack that Mark Mero forced her to wear, and she's wearing a ridiculously skimpy bikini underneath. And Jim Cornette was saying around this time, when they were preparing for the next episode of Raw, after what they did with Steve Austin, very often it was, what are we going to dress Sable up as for this show?
Yeah. The adult, I can't remember, I think it's a Power Slam interview where Jim Cornette loses his mind because they don't focus on the booking of the Patriot. I think they were in Canada.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, if you book the Patriot this way, it's not going to bloody work. But they were so focused on Sable, he couldn't comprehend it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know if Jim Cornette has much of a leg to stand on when it comes to having to go at other people's kinks, but we're not in the kink-shaming world here. Well, maybe we are, but not really. We shouldn't be.
Mm.
I mean, God knows the amount of stuff I have to edit out that Simon talks about. You have no idea.
Right, okay. Chuck me under the bus, will you?
But if you bothered to learn to edit, that's all I'll say. But, so throughout 97, Sable's becoming a more and more figurehead of the company. And as we say, when I started watching WWF again regularly on a weekly basis, when we got Sky in our house at the end of December, start of January, I would say that Sable was the third most prominent character on WWF, the third most prominent storyline on WWF TV after Austin going for the title with DX and the Undertaker situations with Kane.
Yeah.
And just all the mixing and matching around those four figures. What Sable was up to in the mid-card would very often be the third biggest point of the show. I know that there are episodes of Raw is War that ended with Sable brawling with Luna or something along those lines. And that's, again, the difference in the Sable presentation with Mark Mero, because obviously, compared to Randy Savage and Miss Elizabeth, because obviously by 1997, late 97, Mark Mero is not a person that they need to protect and make look like a star.
Yeah.
I mean, 1998 is his last proper full-time active year in wrestling, and the WWF just really... And also, he'd slowed down so significantly, and his heel work just was not fun to watch in the ring.
Mm.
The boxing gimmick was nowhere near as exciting in-ring as the Wild Man gimmick had been.
Yeah, and I can't... I personally don't like the boxing thing in wrestling.
Yeah.
It's wrestling.
Yeah, tell Anthony Ogogo that to his face, Simon.
Anthony Ogogo, now, he can wrestle as well. And Mark certainly could as well. It's just I don't like the boxer gimmick in wrestling. I just don't.
Yeah. Well, it's not that common. I can't think of many other examples.
Mercifully, no, it's not.
But when he came, when, where was I before I was so rudely interrupted?
'98 was his last year.
'98 was like his last year.
His last full-time active year.
So it wasn't like where they had to build Randy Savage and Miss Elizabeth up as a double act. And Randy Savage was still ultimately who they were going to build it around and have. They'd make the money off of Randy more than they would off Miss Elizabeth.
Yeah, absolutely.
But in 1998, the obvious idea was we can make a lot of money from Sable. And they were, you know, there were magazine spreads in Raw magazine that I'm not going to deny I enjoyed at that early age.
Formative years.
Yeah.
In those formative years.
Although I must say, I would think I was always a Sunny person before I was a Sable person. And actually, when she got involved in late 98, I was more of a Jacqueline person than I was a Sable person either, as well. And there's a whole chapter in Confessions of a Smart Wrestling Fan that explains why, citing one match in particular at Capital Carnage. Anyone my age will know exactly what I'm talking about. But yeah, they knew they could build stuff around Sable. And I think the reason that this match is significant is that it proved that Sable had a base level of competence in the ring that meant we can have her in actual matches. We don't have to do a whole rigmarole of getting her involved in angles and stuff that can't be paid off at a pay-per-view with a wrestling card when we can't put her in a wrestling match, like they couldn't do with Miss Elizabeth, they couldn't do with Sunny, they could do with Alundra Blaze, but there wasn't anything else to really build it around, and Alundra Blaze, I don't think, appealed to them in the way that they wanted a woman wrestler to look like. She came close, but she didn't come close enough. She was too much of an actual, you know, athlete who wanted to be a good wrestler.
Yeah, the audacity of the woman.
Now, so that's all my memories of Sable going into this match. I want to know what your memories of Sable are, because I guess the Sable you would have seen would have been the one that popped up suddenly again in 2003 and was having soap opera catfights with Stephanie McMahon and on and off again stuff going on with Tori Wilson.
Yeah, I mean, I've not seen a lot of Sable matches prior, and 2003 was sort of around... I didn't really watch a lot of wrestling at the time in 2003. I've seen a lot of clips back, so I didn't. My knowledge of Sable is just that Mark Merrow's quote about how quickly he learnt forgiveness when he realised who Sable had cheated on him with. Like, oh, no, I don't want it that much. I'm not that bothered.
May I be the first to congratulate you,
Mr. Lesnar.
Do you want me to walk her down the aisle? I will do that happily. Hand you off and be on my way.
Yeah. Absolutely not. and the same with Mark Merrow. I knew about this story, the storyline where Sable eventually breaks away from Mark. Mm. Because that storyline and Sable, again, they reference that a lot in like their lists and clip shows.
Mm.
And when they look back, they speak glowingly of Sable and of how she came across. It's a bit of patting yourself on the back, but she's obviously still got to have, as Lorcan's alluded to, the presence. She's got to have that level of athletic ability where she doesn't absolutely crap the bed and fans turn on her. She doesn't have to like be Manami Toyota.
No.
But she has to have a base level of athletic competence. And in this match, she does everything she's supposed to do pretty well. In fact, it's not her that makes the weird glaring error in this match. It's the men, which I find, I couldn't make head or sense of that.
Was that when they collided in the ring at one
point? Yeah, like
I think
sort of just...
that's a popular Gold Dust spot. I think Dustin likes doing that and making it look somewhat accidental, where it looks like they collide heads. Because I was thinking, it's so fascinating watching this match and knowing that quite bloated Gold Dust that we're seeing in this match is still going today, but he's like 30 pounds lighter.
More nimble.
Well, I have to say, there's plenty of moments where I was impressed that even clearly not a good point in his life mentally, and I think physically either. Yeah. He was still able to move at a decent... Obviously, 20 years younger, it helps as well.
Yeah.
But I wonder if I get the feeling that he was the ring general of this match, that he was directing traffic.
Yeah.
And that maybe he'd been the one that had the most hand in putting it together backstage. Because It's always funny when you see WWF, when they know they've got a special project on their hands, and so often it's with celebrity involvement, how well booked this is. And I have to say, like, structurally, it's a lot shorter than it. But structurally, it follows the same blueprint that Ronda Rousey and Kurt Angle versus Triple H and Stephanie did.
Yeah.
20 years later. Again, one of the reasons why I think this match is so pivotal. If this match hadn't happened, maybe the version that we got later on down the road, it wouldn't have happened in that way either. I think the mixed tag format, they always know you've got to work it a bit more, because there's always the rule of you tag in, it's not intergender. It's you tag in and the men have to go at it, or you tag in and the women have to go at it. So the way they're able to do that, it always helps. Because there has been territory stuff that's done that. There was a famous run in World Class Championship Wrestling between Precious and another valet.
Yeah.
I think had a similar thought. And again, they weren't two really well-trained professional athletes, but the crowd, they were over with the crowd, and that was all that mattered, really. And again, it was something you haven't really seen that much. And you got to remember, this is also at the time of Jerry Springer, the height of the cat fights on TV and everything. And when they do finally get in the ring, engage in it, Jerry Lawler is yelling out, cat fights. And obviously, that was a spot in basically every Tommy Dreamer match in ECW and most Shane Douglas matches in ECW at the same time. But they go more into the wrestling in this one. And it's like, what can Sable do? She can do a powerbomb. Yeah. Mark's trained her how to do his finisher. And it's very obvious she has some sort of martial arts training.
Yes.
That she was, to some degree, an athlete. The kicks that she throws to Luna in the corner look good. The hits that she does to Goldust at various points look pretty good. And Goldust sells them brilliantly too. Everything in the match is catered around making Sable look as good as possible. She has like a 15-second period just before the finish of the match where Luna rakes her in the eyes and chokes her against the ropes. And immediately the crowd is yelling Sable, like chanting Sable at the top of their lungs.
Yeah.
This match must, again, I think this match must have had the third, maybe even the second loudest reaction on the night after Austin Michaels. And probably Undertaker Kane had some of it, but it was also like a longer match with more lulls and a much slower pace, obviously. But with this match, it is just the guys can eat up 6 to 7 minutes of the match with competent wrestling. And the rest is Sable doing these spots and Luna putting her over big time because she is a trained wrestler and knows how to do these bumps. And again, another woman that just was going around looking for someone to wrestle and very often being hired because she had an interesting look, but they had no desire to build a division around her. She made her, I don't know if it was her full debut, but she made the first time I saw her was at WrestleMania 9, where she accompanied Shawn Michaels to the ring for the opening match against Tatanka.
Okay.
Tatanka had Sensational Sherry, who was doing, like, it was her first face run in the WWF, and she was doing her Woman Scorn thing because Shawn Michaels had, like, pushed her in the way of Marty Jannetty hitting him with Shawn Michaels' mirror. And so she took it full blast to the head, and then she spent the next few months going after Shawn and trying to cost him the title.
Yeah.
And after that match is over, Luna attacks and beats the shit out of her. Luna was... Like, if Luna was around now, she'd be definitely under... In some contract, she'd be at a minimum in a role similar to Abaddon.
Yeah. In the promo package before the match, her line of, I'm going to take your Estee Lauder face and make it an Andy Warhol original. I rate that. I rate that line highly. And the way she delivers it, her voice, like there's a compelling nature to it. I was drawn to the presentation and what she was conveying.
Yeah, and now with Sable, she finally had someone that she could bounce off of where that worked. Sensational Sherry. They had a right old brawl on an early Monday Night Raw episode, but yeah. Sherry was out of the company pretty soon afterwards, so they never were able to do a proper follow-up, and those would have been, like, a precursor to the introduction of the women's division later that year with Alundra Blaze. I wonder if that was already something they had in mind, that they were going to set those two up against each other and then bring Alundra in and build a promotion around them. And after Luna had her first run with Alundra Blaze, they kept her on as the manager of Bull Nakano.
Yeah.
Which, again, must be so frustrating. But again, it's like, we're not going to have two women's matches on a card. What are you, mad? Be happy you're a manager. And she did bounce
around.
There's
a Tony Khan joke in there somewhere, but well, yeah. I'm not going to make it.
But you have two titles. Yeah, but you know.
No, I don't.
And I feel like you don't either. I don't. It's true. Oh, yes. Go on. Sorry.
I know we're going off track. But
us?
I saw a fantastic tweet from someone mocking Fulham fans of Tony Khan sold Aleksandar Mitrovic to the Saudis so he could pay Will Ospreay and Okada. Cheers, guys.
In fairness, I don't think it was him that wanted to sell Mitrovic.
Mitrovic defo wanted to go, yeah.
Mitrovic is like the CM Punk of football in many ways.
Just never fit in at Newcastle. Yeah. But that's by the by.
But back to this one. So yeah, Luna's done her role brilliantly. And for her to have that humility, it's very hard. I mean, to essentially be what your gimmick is that you're ugly and scary and no man would ever want to touch you unless they're a 400-pound, tattooed-headed Bam Bam Bigelow or a man going through mental health issues. With the Goldust character.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I've always had a huge soft spot for this artist formerly known as Goldust run. Because genuinely, one of the things about WWF in the early 98, late 97, and it was the good part of Russo, you really didn't know what was going to happen on every episode.
Yeah.
You didn't know when Austin would just turn up and stunner someone. Especially in the build-up to the Royal Rumble, because he was just coming in at random moments. You didn't know when Kane was going to come out and chokeslam someone. And when Goldust's little, like, feedback flare-up came, you didn't know what music was about to play and what costume this guy was about to wear. Vince Russo weirdly having an obsession with the artist formerly known as, because then when he went to WCW, he then repackaged Prince Iaukea as the artist formerly known as Prince Iaukea.
Oh, that's just... That was right there.
Yeah, but that was like a literal Prince, like 1985 thing. Whereas, as we were saying, with Goldust, it was like an Andy Warhol postmodern reinterpretation of whatever he would feel like wearing that time. And sometimes it would just be like even further down the fetishistic line. I remember he came out with like a ball gag in his mouth, or he'd sometimes wear like leather fetish gear. Other times he would come out, one time he came out dressed as his dad in the polka dots and everything. Mm. Another time he had a match against Mankind and he came out dressed as Dude Love. I know at least one time he came out proper blacked up. And I he mean did. like Dutch, that... the Dutch, that bloke in the Dutch Christmas marches level of blacked up.
Yeah, there's that really awkward one now of him in the afro and the sunglasses. That one's seared into my brain when we talk about this. Mm. It's just but like, what were you thinking? Even then,
but it was But it was a fascinating turning up of the Goldust character after he'd... And it's, again, weird when you look back at it how condensed all these runs are. Like, he only turned up in WWF as Goldust in, like, late 95.
Yeah.
And he's done the run as a heel. He's then done the babyface turn. And he was involved in some really great stuff. Like, he's in the Canadian Stampede main events. Mm. He's doing all that. There's the Hollywood Backlot Brawl with Roddy Piper, which, as I said in the previous episode, is one of those real precursors. That was a match that would have slot into WrestleMania 14 way better than any other match on this card.
Yeah.
And Goldust was one of those first steps of Vince and the WWF in general really experimenting with what a wrestling character could be again. Because obviously so much of it was Adrian Street, Gorgeous George, Adorable Adrian Adonis. But there was a more abstract, like, making it a Hollywood glamour 1920s thing.
Yeah.
Maybe they... You know what? It shouldn't have been Doc Luther as Tony Storm's butler, shouldn't it?
Ah!
Or they should have brought back Marlena. if Terry Runnels fancied it. But yeah, playing up the ambiguity and everything. And I've always had a big, you know, I think if I do my top 40 wrestlers, I think Dustin Rhodes would be in it because of the journey he's been on and the fact that he can still have, you know, we were saying, what, a 27-year gap between two matches that Meltzer gave 5 stars to? Some of the Sting can do, so in your face, Sting.
Look, he is a freak of nature, and we mentioned him, like, not being at his lightest here, but still being nimble. Have you seen the clip of Dusty Rhodes playing basketball and sending people to the shadow realm? It's in his DNA.
Yeah, they're very good. They're light on their feet, those boys.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, and as I said, I wonder if he's the one that structured this match and put it all together and was the one dictating people on what to do. And obviously, I was trying to see if I could see it, like Luna communicating with Sable what she has to do at every point. Like, Sable has to have her hand held throughout it all. But what she's required to do, she does. Yeah. And the reaction when she does the powerbomb for the first time, everyone's like, oh my God. And while she doesn't get the win off of it here, pretty soon that became her finisher.
Yeah, the Sable bomb was her finisher. That's what, that confused me, because I'm like, oh, we're going to not have that as the pin. And then, okay, it's Mero. It's her hitting Mero's finisher. Okay, that makes sense for where she's at in the process, I guess.
It is funny seeing how they had to, again, because they needed to have people they knew they could work because they didn't know one way or the other yet with Sable. And so they had to have Mero semi-turn face insofar as he didn't want, because Goldust was like, had his hands on her when he was trying to break her up when she was brawling with Luna. Mero took exception to that. And when they do their passage of a match, Mero is working the babyface out of the two of them. And we are seeing a return to the few of those wild man spots. He does the double jump moonsault and nearly lands on his head in the process.
Yeah.
So it's probably a good reason why he'd stop doing that for most of his matches anyway.
But, look, yeah, he's making his most of the moment in the spotlight, and...
And the joke is that he's trying to take up the spotlight at the end of the match as well. It's funny,
Her facial expression, Sable's facial expressions are incredible. She looks pissed when he comes into the ring to raise her hand.
She looks pissed off from bell start to bell. I nearly did a word. from the starting bell to the finishing bell. And she played that off well, and that's good, really, because all the time Sable had made her entrances, she always had a smile on her face. And like I said, that sort of version of Miss Elizabeth, but Miss Elizabeth, if she looked like a Playboy centerfold, literally, in the case of Sable, as time went on. And just waving to the crowd, like a little sort of like, you always know if someone's like naive in wrestling if they just wave when they make their entrance. Yeah. I also thought that was a good little thing that Sean Waltman would do as the 1-2-3 kid. Like, he'd just wave. It's like, I can't believe I'm here. I'm up. But with this one, because as they showed, like, I don't know if it was the Raw before this, where Sable had, she'd been handcuffed against the ring post and Luna had just smeared her face in makeup and everything, that there was a reason she looked like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was like, and they showed in the picture, and I said, these were show-ending angles of her calling Luna a bitch and telling her to come back in and then fighting again. And, like, showing a fire that Miss Elizabeth never had to show.
Yeah.
Even when she was in the WrestleMania 8 match with Ric Flair, that was as edgy as she got. And I don't even know if Sonny would have had that in her if she just had too much of a sense of... Her whole thing was just having a sense of fun and being such a, you know... I don't know. Even when she was a heel.
Dirty tag team harlot.
Yes. Well, Simon, I tried to edit the other 50 times you said that in this episode, but that's the one that's going in.
What's she going to do?
So, were you surprised, again, because you said you saw the Sable that was like, by the time she came back, the women's division had overtaken her, and she wasn't involved in those matches. The only other WrestleMania match she has after this run... She is involved in WrestleMania 15 with Tori, where they are doing like that All About Eve storyline that Toni Storm is obviously doing with Mariah May now, and that they also did a sort of with Trish Stratus and Mickie James.
Yes.
But with Sable, she did that match with Tori. Very, very bad match. And at that point, she turned heel because she started to stand up for herself backstage, and apparently that made her really spoilt. She was gone within 15 months of this run. She was gone and filing a $100 million lawsuit against the WWF, which nowadays I think people will be a lot more sympathetic to.
Yeah.
And it would be quite good to reopen that case file to see what's in there. Mm. You could have saved everyone a lot of time and horror.
Considering who her husband is, though, I don't think that's going to happen.
Not now. Well, yeah, that's the other thing. You know what's another crazy thing I just want to say quickly before I forget? You know Mark Mero isn't black, right?
Yeah.
They really wanted to make you think he was black. And not just in WWF, in WCW when he was doing a Little Richard gimmick. The man is Jewish. It's kind of like that, you know, hiring an Italian to play Muhammad Hassan or hiring anyone from Polynesia to play a Japanese wrestler.
Yep. Yokozuna.
Yep. Though, to be fair, I used to criticize, but then when I watched a Yokozuna match recently, they did say that he was from Polynesia.
Yeah.
So I think maybe they copped to it that he's not actually Japanese.
And I think some Polynesians do compete in sumo.
Oh, yeah, obviously.
In fairness, yeah.
You know, Polynesians are overrepresented in many sports for their number.
Can you imagine the first time a Japanese sumo coach, like, when...
Lumpus. In a way.
Was in power of, like, union laws. Yeah, probably.
But anyway, so, yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you with Sable. So the Sable you knew was just... part of the furniture, just one of the many divas in the roster. The only WrestleMania match you would have seen her during that run was when she was in the Playboy evening gown match, in which they all just took off their evening gowns right at the start.
Yeah.
With her and Tori Wilson against Stacy Keibler and Miss Jackie.
Yes, that's the one. That's WrestleMania 20, right?
Yes, that's right.
Yes. Yeah, I remember because... I don't know why I remember this line, but there's two inter-brand matches on that card, and Taz makes the joke that he won the coin toss for him and Michael Cole to get this one, rather than the Goldberg-Brock Lesnar one. So, oh, no, we'll have this one.
Well, you know.
And Taz is like, I'll just get Jerry Lawler's sulking because we got this one, but I'll get his line in anyway and just shout puppies down the mic. Like, cheers, lads. Feminism and that.
But yeah, she was just part of the furniture. She was the heel. I mean, in many ways, I think they... Because obviously, what's the first thing Vince does when he gets Sable to come back is he books her to be his concubine and get involved in all sorts of lascivious things backstage, which was his want with pretty much any woman in wrestling. And then eventually she leaves to live in Brock Lesnar's compound.
Yeah.
And be underneath him when he was celebrating UFC victories.
Mm.
I mean, if there's ever a divorce and there's a book, God knows what we could get there.
I don't know.
But yeah, but were you surprised knowing that Sable? Like, this Sable was on the face of posters. Like, if you get King of the Ring 1998, in spite of it being the Hell in a Cell match and everything, it is Sable that is on the cover. Yeah. It's Sable that does the Playboy magazine that at the time they said was the best-selling Playboy magazine of all time. And I can believe them, because Sable was a prominent figure in pop culture in 1998 after Stone Cold Steve Austin and The Undertaker. And that, I mean, she was one of the people that speaks in the Super Bowl commercial.
Mm-hmm. No, I knew because of like the WrestleMania clip shows and the compilation DVDs I'd seen. I knew, but I hadn't seen this match in its entirety. And you're right, it's every time she's in the ring. It's not like, oh, it's the Sable bit and then she sells herself short. Mm. No, she's a very active contributant to...
Contributants?
Yeah, contributor. Sorry. That's staying in, isn't it?
Oh, God, yeah.
she's a very active contributor, not only to the match, but how her character's coming across. She's not been thrust in that position and is floundering.
No.
She's thriving.
But then when they had her wrestle one-on-one matches, that's when it started to fall apart.
Yeah.
She has decent enough matches against Jacqueline. Again, Jacqueline, a more experienced wrestler, when they brought her in. And she does have one more run with Luna. They introduced the evening gown match at the next show, Unforgiven, and somehow Sable loses that match. But then they built it up around her with Mark Merrow. Mark Merrow beats her at the Over the Edge pay-per-view after saying he was going to lose to her, and then he turns it into a cradle, and that meant she would have to leave the WWF. And then she came back, and they really... Then Mark Merrow took on, you know, he was on the rebound, and Jacqueline was his rebound. And again, they got back into the Jerry Springer thing, and they were making Viagra jokes and all that sort of stuff. Had a bikini contest at Fully Loaded. I Became a Man. They... They had a similar tag team match to this at SummerSlam, but Mark Merrow on the heel side, and they brought in Edge as the babyface. And they actually had, again, it was following that formula. Sable stays on the outside until the crowd's screaming for her to get involved. Jacqueline's been trying to dodge her, just like Luna tries to dodge her. She gets in, hits her moves, and then they finish her off. And I remember the finish they did for the SummerSlam match was the old finisher, I think, that Edge and Christian had on the indie scene, because Christian hadn't signed with the company yet. Where Christian essentially does a backwards roll into a sort of wheelbarrow position that you do for a wheelbarrow plex.
Yep.
But instead, Edge, like, forward splashes, like, forward slams her, and she splashes onto Mark Merrow, I think, and gets to pin Mark Merrow.
Okay.
And then after that whole run with Merrow's over with, and she wins the women's title, Jacqueline wins it first, and then that's to set up the rematch, and Sable wins it at Survivor Series 98. Mark Merrow loses to Gilbert and says he's going to leave wrestling if he can't beat that jobber. And pretty much he did.
Yeah.
Not necessarily what they intended to do, but that's how it turned out. He had, I know he was on like one TNA pay-per-view, like in 2004 or something. But pretty much Mark Merrow, I know that he's like a motivational speaker, and he would be a very regular guy that they go to when he just wanted to shit on the WWF because of Benoit or anything else. I'm sure he's made a few public statements now in recent weeks. And again, he was one of those guys that was probably seen as bitter.
Yeah.
But in hindsight, the truth shall set you free. I think he must be feeling right now.
Oh, I think he's in the right. Yeah, he definitely thinks that.
And again, I wonder what Sable thinks now when she sees of everything. Like, did she experience... Maybe she got off in relative terms quite easy. I don't know. But it was the start. But this is like... It's funny because of how we've got these booked and set up. To give it away, listeners, we are going to do the WrestleMania 35 main event that I say, really? This match? If this match hadn't been a hit, they would have kept pushing Sable, but they would have kept her out of the matches. And if they'd have kept her out of the matches, there'd be no purpose in having a women's title. But they got a women's title for Sable. And then, do you remember how Sable dropped that belt? Do you know how Sable dropped it?
No.
Because she started to go off TV. They just weren't having a show up. Eventually, because she was like fighting her case, they turned her heel, gave her Nicole Bass as like a muscle-bound enforcement. And she was the heel against Tori at WrestleMania, and they had an awful match because Tori was never really that good a wrestler,
yeah,
in all honesty, and couldn't carry Sable even for like the 5 minutes that they had to do. And so easily they could have dropped the belt at that point. But, and because she ended up losing the belt to Deborah when they were booked in an evening gown match, but Deborah was distracted by, well, the week before, Sable just recorded a thing on video saying, I'm not going to do this. I'm a star now. I've done Playboy. I don't need you. And again, the crowd wasn't clamoring for her to turn heel. Again, it's like the crowd wasn't clamoring for Becky Lynch to turn heel. But if you suddenly do something Vince doesn't like, you can very quickly become heel.
Yes.
Is my basic feeling of how he goes with women.
And men.
More women, though.
Yeah, well, I've just got Roman Reigns. Oh, you want time off because you're scared of this? Like, you're scared. Your immune system can't handle COVID.
Yeah, but I'm just thinking more Sasha Banks and Naomi saying that's stupid, and literally the commentators having to say the words of Vince was probably barking in their ear at that point about someone having poor conduct in the workplace. Well, go fuck yourself, Vince.
Yeah. And Pat McAfee just staring into the camera like, what am I working in?
Yeah. So then they have the evening hour match the week after, and Val Venus comes out and distracts Deb because Nicole Bass came in her place and Deborah took off her dress to avoid just wrestling Nicole Bass. And at this point, Deborah is every bit as popular as Sable was back then because they followed the formula.
Yeah.
What was popular. But Deborah genuinely didn't have in-ring ability. None at all. She was more down the Sable route. But she won the title after Sable ripped her dress off. But Shawn Michaels was the commissioner and he was on commentary just shitting all over Sable for the entirety of the... Watch the segment. It's so bad. Even at the time, I was like, this seems out of line.
Yeah.
And this doesn't make sense because his logic of is like, if you've got puppies like that, which was how he put it with Deborah, you should win the match. Therefore, Deborah won the match and she's the women's champion because you took her dress off.
Wrestling.
Sable, to be fair, Sable was no-selling everything. So maybe Sable had genuinely had enough and was going to be unprofessional. But I'm not going to have a go at anyone else being unprofessional in a WWF working environment, especially in 1999. Mm. And so that's Sable gone. And they could have easily just... The women's belt could have gone the same way the Cruiserweight belt did when it went on to Hornswoggle. Because that's what Deborah basically was.
Yeah.
But by then... Because they obviously felt, I think they felt they had to shore up a women's division in case Sable, they could build it around. So you did have Nicole Bass. You did have Ivory by that point. You did have Tori. You did have Jacqueline still. And there must have always been at the back of their mind, we can always do something with China. Even though around this time, China's involved in the Intercontinental Division. So they kept it going. And I've got to think... While she may not have necessarily been why she got drawn into wrestling as that much, I feel like Trish Stratus watching that match and seeing someone who looks like her and has probably gone down a similar kind of path, and she knew that fitness modeling could only take her so far.
Yeah.
And she liked sporting athleticism, and obviously Trish had more athletic ability than Sable. And so she turns up on their radar and it's like, well, this person looks better than Sable, probably. You know, it's all objective, subjective, but she's younger than Sable. She seems to have a desire to want to improve in the ring, which Sable doesn't have.
Yeah.
So I'm saying, like, Sonny, if Miss Elizabeth and Sonny begat Sable, Sable begat Trish Stratus, Trish Stratus begat what eventually became... The Divas in one end of it, but there was enough there for women to also be drawn into it.
Yeah.
I always say one of the most significant reactions I ever thought watching, and I noticed it when I was watching it, and why I still think we might do something about Trish and Lita as a rerun the rivalry of some description, is when they had that six-man tag and Trish was brought in and she was the heel going in, but eventually they obviously wanted to make her the face of the... Like, she was as prominent as Sable was, really, in the branding for a much longer stretch of time and left on good terms. But when Lita came into the ring, girls in the crowd were going crazy.
Yeah.
Now, Sable wasn't being catered towards girls in this show, but girls did eventually find something to look up to. And if Sable hadn't made that niche in a card where they feel we should put a women's match in this and we've got a women's title and we're going to keep it going and we're going to keep prominence of it, maybe we would have never got that far, and then the women's division just gradually builds and builds over time, and then NXT, without Triple H, without Vince having to look at it,
yeah,
appeals to them, and Ronda Rousey gets to see a side of wrestling. If Ronda Rousey had only seen Sable, I'm guessing she may not have been that engaged in wanting to be a wrestler. But, like I said, I think this match could have been something that Trish Stratus saw and thought, I can do that. And I can get over with that crowd. And that's where we are today, I think.
Yeah,
that's why I think there is a through line from this to the WrestleMania 34 match between Ronda Rousey and Kurt Angle against Triple H and Stephanie, which is basically a remake of this match in so many ways.
Yeah.
And then a year from there, you've got the women main eventing a WrestleMania. So that's my thesis for this episode.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't disagree, to be brutally honest. I think I always find it difficult where it's like, if this hadn't happened, then this hadn't happened, because how far does a butterfly effect ever really go? Because there's always like mitigating factors, fate and lightning in a bottle. However, to change a landscape, which this match did in a sense, because the women's title got reestablished basically off because of Sable, and because they put this match in a prominent position on a WrestleMania card, again for the third time in history in 14 years that they had done it at that particular point, shows that they were all in, and then being all in on a female wrestler at that time like that meant that they would have to build around her. And from building around her, you get Jacqueline getting the stage that she gets. You get different styles of wrestling being shown on a mainstream platform. You get Trish. You get Lita. And from Trish and Lita, you get the inspiration of your Lynch's, your Sasha Banks, your Bayley's, your Flair's. So this is, and I'm viewing this from my age range when I say this. I think this is the prequel to the launch pad. But that's me looking from my age range. Yeah. I could totally accept from your age range and you viewing wrestling in the way you were at the time and looking back now, while you're saying that this is the launch pad.
Yeah, well, you know, I had my mind slightly blown by seeing Bull Nakano and Alundra Blaze and knowing, well, I know that women can wrestle. It's not like they're physically incapable of doing it, which seemed to be the attitude, like they can wrestle, but only they can do hair mares and maybe you can do a move off the bottom rope.
Yeah, it's like that line in Brass Eye, women were considered too silly for space.
Yeah, but it's that great gag in the Southpaw Regional Wrestling Series where they keep building up Natty Neidhart debuting for the promotion and then they realise they don't have any other women, so she can't do anything.
Yeah, and it's John Cena just going, I still think it's a tiny, misshapen man. A lot about how John Cena's now coming across in the comedies that he does does stem back to Southpaw Regional Wrestling. And he is funny. He is.
But yeah, everything comes after something else. And also, it doesn't, just because something came after it doesn't mean it came because of it.
Yeah.
But I do think you can say, because of that, because of that, because of that. And one of those points is, Sonny was a magnetic personality. Because of that, they started to give another woman a prominent position based on a look that they'd never quite had before. Because of that, they then gave Sable a chance because she had no experience within the wrestling industry when they brought her in.
Yeah.
Because of that, etc., etc., etc. Because of Sable, because of Sonny, because she's very often dubbed the first diva, and I do agree with that.
Yeah.
Assigned credit to her. So because of Sonny you get Sable, and I think because of Sable you get Trish, and because of Trish you get women continuing to stay prominent for the rest of the early two. And Lita as well.
Yeah.
Although maybe Lita came in through a different way because she obviously had the love of Lucha and everything. And obviously China as well, a significant part of it too.
Oh yeah.
And one thing I think we could definitely do as a match of the week, I've always wanted to talk about the Lita-China match, which is pretty much the only time that China ever made a woman, sold for a woman in wrestling. Mm. And what we could have had if China had played ball in that.
Yeah.
But again, shocking high number of women that for some reason can't play ball and have to be got rid of a lot quicker than Randy Orton.
And the fact that Randy Orton now gets to say it in promos. Yeah, I have had loads of second chances because I'm mint. I mean,
I do want to say, like, do you have any other observation about the match? Just like how hot this crowd is as well.
Oh,
like,
yeah. And the attitudes towards women aren't, it's not just the WWF.
Yeah.
So the sign in the front row, Sable can't wrestle, but you should see her box. Come on, lads. Come
as
on.
As far man. As wrestling, like if that sign was all correctly spelt as well. You've got to actually give that one credit. That's like, that's the Mensa member of the crowd as far as wrestling crowds go at that point. And that little boy proposing to her as well, all sorts of things.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think this is a match. I did not expect Sable to be doing this stuff when I saw it on screen.
Mm.
And obviously, again, now in hindsight, you're like, a powerbomb is basically the other person doing all the work. And that's the thing watching this, like seeing the work that Luna's having to do to put and to be willing to look like a coward. Like she's at one point more willing to wrestle Mark Mero than she is to wrestle Sable.
Oh, the bit when she gets clotheslined out of the ring and Sable clearly doesn't hit her hard enough for her to justify taking that flip. So Sable then has to, like, push her.
Yeah, and it is like, Luna did love the business and she'd grown up in the business, idolizing her father and her uncle.
Mm.
And the business was so cruel to her in comparison. I saw her live, actually, at the WWA. She was doing an intergender hardcore match with her husband.
Okay.
It was quite fun to watch them doing that. Like, at one point, Gangrel gets on one knee and offers a goblet of his blood. It's like a peace offering to her.
She was married to Gang. That's a thing about wrestling. I've gone was straight away because it's wrestling.
It's the default. Yeah. Very sad. But yeah. So let's. And she had wrestled. She was in the second mixed match herself.
Yeah.
So there is a lineage to this. But that one, a woman was the equivalent of a little person.
Yeah.
Because it was her and Bam Bam against Doink and Dink.
Yeah.
I remember the lyric that Oscar from Men on a Mission did in the build-up to that card. Doink and Dink, you know they like to joke. Bam Bam and Luna might go up in smoke.
Bars.
As Mean Gene might say, Longfellow couldn't have said it better. That wasn't a diss on Dink with the Longfellow suggestion.
Oh, boo. You should have led into that, not out of it.
But yeah, I think this is a match that maybe some people will forget its significance. Mm. And that was why on a major card, I mean, if you want to run down the rest of the card, like, as I said, this is the closest to another WrestleMania 1. This is, you can say, like, the day after this, Shawn Michaels is retired for 4 years. Except for one match. Steve Austin stuns Vince McMahon for the second time. The new WWF Championship belt is debuted. I think this must be coming up on the last WWF match where... Again, it's like that funny like hybrid period. So the logo for WWF is still the old logo, but they are using the Scratch Attitude Era logo as much at that time. The great Intercontinental Championship belt design is replaced by, I don't care what you say, Simon, the inferior oval-shaped Intercontinental belt.
Now, there's a generational battle between the two of us.
But yeah, the card, I mean, it really did, like, I do also think something should be said about how I'd love to, what'd be amazing would be to interview JR during his time at this point as the talent relations guy, where he's starting to work on a developmental system that eventually produces John Cena, Shelton Benjamin, Brock Lesnar, Randy Orton, Batista, and arguably also figures like Trish Stratus and Mickie James and so on and so forth. And also at this time he's bringing in Edge and Christian and everyone. But like, the roster that he starts to accumulate at this time is fascinating to look at. If you look at, I remember I rewatched the 1998 Royal Rumble, and what I couldn't get over was the size of everyone. Mm. Not just, obviously, this is a time of ridiculous physiques, but also just almost everyone is like at least 6'2". And the ones that aren't really do stick out, like Scott Taylor and Brian Christopher.
Yep.
And again, it's one of those things where you realize in hindsight just how big Jeff and Matt Hardy were, but in relative to when they're standing next to the Young Bucks, but in relative terms, they were. But yeah,
I'm thinking of that football Mitchell and Webb look sketch, making them both look normal sized.
Yeah, but I was saying with WrestleMania 12, their roster was so weak at that point that there's 22 wrestlers on the whole card. This pay-per-view opens with a 30-man Battle Royal, which is the thing that they always show at the start of the Royal Rumble stats thing, because it's the only time 30 people have been in the ring for a Battle Royal, even though it wasn't a Royal Rumble. And my God, if we had to sit through a Royal Rumble where there were 30 people in the ring by the end of it, that'd be a tough hour.
Yeah. So, to go into the card... Lorcan's right. That is how it opens. It's a tag team battle royal for the number one contendership, won by LOD 2000 on their
Although
return.
They're not announced as LOD 2000 in the show.
No, they are wearing the 2000 tights, though.
Yeah, and they've got the helmets, and They've removed their usual haircuts for just a crew cut, but it's also the last time Sunny was part of a repackaging.
Yeah.
And, yeah, she was gone soon enough, and then they brought in Draws, and then Hawk became a drug addict on screen as well as in real life. And, oh, boy. The Legion of Doom in the WWF.
Cursed. But, yeah,
last eliminating whom, Simon?
That is the Midnight Express, Bodacious Bart and Bombastic Bob with Jim Cornette as manager. Bet he loved that.
Bart Gunn and Bob Holly. Bart Gunn and Bob Holly.
Oh, dear. Then we move on to Taka Michinoku defeating Aguila for the light heavyweight championship.
Mm-hmm. So this was the time when they were trying to have a reaction to the cruiserweight division, but again, it was like, we've got Taka, and we'll just give Taka a challenger. And like, the light heavyweight, as I said, the light heavyweight title, the cruiserweight title could have very easily been the path that the women's title went down, and
yeah,
it didn't.
Yeah. Then we've got Triple H defeating Owen Hart for the to retain the European Championship.
That was one that made me so bitter about it in hindsight, because I thought going into the 98 Royal Rumble that Owen was going to win it and beat Shawn for the belt at WrestleMania 14. That's how convinced I was that Owen was going to be the main event star I'd always hoped he would be. And instead, he has to lose to Triple H. And is maybe the first kind of do unto others what the Ultimate Warrior did unto him 2 years earlier.
He gives him more time than the Ultimate Warrior gave him, but that's by the by. Then we have the match that we've discussed, Mark Merrow, obviously, and Sable winning. We move then on to The Rock defeating Ken Shamrock by disqualification to retain the IC title.
Originally, it was booked that Ken Shamrock just beat the shit out of him for 5 minutes. Again, similar to Sable, that is just pissed off and going to take names. And then The Rock submitted, and they just did the Jerry Lawler, Bret Hart, SummerSlam 93 finish again, where Ken Shamrock wouldn't let go of the hold, started beating the shit out of the referees. So they reversed the decision, and The Rock won by DQ. And did the whole Jerry Lawler thing, went out on a stretcher, but with his arm holding the belt up, as if he had a great victory.
Oh.
But that's the point. Triple H in the European title match, The Rock in the Intercontinental title match. And I think the next one, again, another guy who become a prominent part of the WWF, where they were a year before this.
So that is Cactus Jack and Chainsaw Charlie defeating the New Age Outlaws to win the titles on the night in a dumpster match.
But that awkward, incorrect legal dumpster, read the fine print. One of the finest reasons to vacate the title I've ever heard. It's like close to the Father Ted, wait a minute, these are fake hands!
Then we move on to the semi-main event.
But I just want to go back to that quick, like just from that, Mick Foley, who then becomes the first guy that they put against Austin, and just the run Mick Foley has after this, and this is also by now established the three faces of Foley and the New Age Outlaws. When you consider where they were at WrestleMania 13 time, they were just like, literally would have, if you were to rank each member of the main roster of like significance of like, if you were to say there was a ranking system like AEW currently employs, they would have been like the bottom two names. Mm-hmm. But because of what they were doing with the Attitude Era and how they were repackaging and presenting people, and you know, they won those belts from the Legion of Doom, and at the time it was like, really, these guys? And it just shows, again, like when people say, oh, someone's been jobbed out for life and they'll never get over and we shouldn't ever bother with them again. Where New Age Outlaws were, and then when they are at this WrestleMania 14, and then they're like, they are that is the main event of the Raw after WrestleMania, is them winning those belts back in steel cage match, forming the new DX with Triple H and X-Pac returning the night after, and China. Like, it just, again, it just goes to show anyone could end up being a star. You don't know.
Yeah.
And always, always keep, never, it feels like you never dismiss anyone out of hand. And it genuinely doesn't matter how many times that they can lose and lose badly. You can turn that person into a star in the right way.
I swear you're about to quote Popstar, never stop, never stopping then.
Or Don't Stop Believing, to quote Journey.
Yeah.
Band almost as farcical.
As the savage. We then move on to our...
We have had some incredible thoughts. We have had some incredible thoughts, though, this episode, oh, yeah. Simon. We should... Don't forget it.
The semi-main event is Undertaker defeating Kane.
My memory of that was one of the best matches I'd ever seen when I first saw it. And then I watched it, most of it again recently. And I mentioned this to Novelist and it was like, oh, okay. But that's another one of those great Undertaker moments.
Yeah.
And the way that Kane had been built from the Bad Blood match to this point was incredible. And I think everyone, both our generations will have a place in our hearts for Kane, the character.
Yes.
Not the man himself.
There you go.
And Simon's got a very special little corner dedicated to his corporate Kane shrine.
Dress Pants Glenn. Me and my mates always used to refer to him as. And the main event, of course, Stone Cold Steve Austin defeating Shawn Michaels to win the WWF Championship.
If you talk about celebrity involvement in wrestling, it's Mr. T that sparks off... Mr. T and Cyndi Lauper sparks off from WrestleMania 1. And that's why I say this is the other WrestleMania 1. It is Mike Tyson's... Mike Tyson in 1998, you've got to realise, is one of the most famous people in the world.
Yeah.
And as I said, he was... That was on a newspaper at school the next day I came into school.
In England.
In England, exactly.
Yeah.
Still think it was a fast count, though.
Well, who's going to tell him?
That is true. Sean tried to, but...
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's not the best WrestleMania, but I think it's maybe one that has the most nostalgic warmth to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think... You can argue after WrestleMania 3, you could argue it's the most important WrestleMania.
Yeah, you genuinely could,
mate. This was a few weeks after this, Raw beats Nitro in the ratings for the first time. The Mr. McMahon character's born. I thought one of the greatest lines I read in the whole situation that we've been experiencing third hand, obviously.
Yeah.
Is that they say that all great wrestlers are essentially themselves turned up to 11. It turns out the Mr. McMahon character was him turned down to 4.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, God, it's so...
The last day of the Winged Eagle belt as well. I mean, if Cody wants to bring it back like he did the Intercontinental belt, I'm not going to disapprove. But cross that bridge when we come to it.
I mean, it is WrestleMania 40. It would be a nice landmark moment to do something... Oh, you've put that in my head now.
They won't do it. Again, like, you got to think, like, the nostalgic glow of a belt that literally hasn't been present for 26 years at this point. Like, that is literally a nostalgia that only almost people younger than me, that, like, don't have any emotional attachment to at all.
Yeah, that's true.
But I wouldn't be against it.
Stranger things have happened.
And the WWE have done that occasionally on their websites. They've had wrestlers pose with classic belts. And
there's a very good shot of Roman with the Winged Eagle.
Yeah, it looks good. It looks right. But anyway. But it's not got a massive logo on it, Simon. So can it possibly be a belt anymore?
Well, we haven't had a Triple H main championship rebrand yet. We've had a new belt be introduced, and
that seems like the ultimate compromise between what Triple H wants from a belt, which is basically the big gold belt, and what Vince wanted from a belt.
Yeah.
And probably Nick Khan and the others, which is a massive logo. Loads of sportsmen wear when they're walking around after they've won a big match.
Yeah. But it works as a marketing strategy.
If Arsenal win the league, and they already have a history of WWF entrance music, which one of them is going to be most likely to be walking around with a WWE Championship belt, do you reckon? If they win the Premier League this season.
I don't know why.
Feels like some...
I don't know why, but I've got Declan Rice in my head.
Yeah, that is exactly who I was about to say. I can see him doing that.
Yeah.
That's by the by. Is there anything else we have left to cover at this point?
No, not really.
But again, I think when people think of WrestleMania 14, they think Austin winning the belt, Shawn Michaels retiring, Undertaker beating Kane. And if you'd have been there at the time, you would have thought Sable revealing it seemed that she was a good wrestler. or at least under the smoke and mirrors and the work of everyone else involved in that match. And Sable, she did enough to look like a good wrestler.
Yeah.
And as I said, you can argue from there, we get Becky Two Belts.
It's a through line. There is. And it wasn't my... I don't like to be dismissive of Lorcan's theory. It's just a lot of people incorrectly use the butterfly effect theory. So I do come in with a level of cynicism towards it. But in this case, it holds water.
I was going to make an Ashton Kutcher joke there. But there are many other things we can have a go at him for than that movie.
Well, look, he's bought it on himself.
Well, anyway, for the next episode, Simon, if this is arguably day one of the Attitude Era, you can argue that this is the final day of the Attitude Era that we're covering for the next episode. Where are we? When is it? And who are we talking to for the episode as our guests?
So, we are at WrestleMania 17. We are at the Houston Astrodome. We're looking at Stone Cold Steve Austin taking on The Rock. And we're looking at it alongside the lovely gentleman from the Awesome Truth podcast. And their names are...
Steve Cimino and Walt Schwenk.
A lovely conversation with these two guys. And I hope you'll enjoy it as much as me and Lorcan did having the conversation.
Well, we've kind of given away that we've gone back on ourselves here. You've shattered the dreams of the audience and pulled that curtain away like Toto.
Ah, that curtain call.
But until that episode that we've already done, there's nothing left to say except, Simon, if people want to get in touch with you with other ways of disputing theories or maybe vaccines or whatever else you want to ruin the fun of.
Bloody hell! I don't mind them when they're linked to my own stupidity or things I've said wrong. But that's just out of left field. That's not even true.
Again, listeners, you wouldn't believe what I've had to edit out over these years. By the way, I'm not going to edit this episode. I've decided... So what you've had, listeners, is the full facts, unedited, talking over each other because we can't employ the flipping conch system I keep saying we need to do. So you've been getting the proper Lord of the Flies anarchy of a usual recording. But we're working to tight deadlines here.
Yeah. We know no other way.
But anyway, if people want to do that, Simon, talk about chemtrails and the like, how can they do so?
Christ. People can get in touch with me on Twitter, where I'm so known as Simon Cross Free. Free for the number of body doubles that Queen Elizabeth II employed throughout her reign. Sod it, I'm going to lean into this.
My name's Lorcan Mullen. That's LORCANMULLAN for another tissue is needed to clean up this mess.
Hey!
Teenage Lorcan. That's my Twitter handle, Instagram, Facebook, Letterboxd. If you put it at gmail.com at the end of it, that's my email address. Get in touch with the show at lmtyspod@gmail.com. LMTYSpod is also our Twitter and Facebook handles. But there's nothing left to say at this point except that my name's Lorcan Mullen.
And my name's Simon Cross.
Congratulations for making it this far. And I hope you... stay with us for whatever reason you justify it as we continue March Mania.